Okay. Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Budget Division will come to order. We're going to start with Senator Fischbach's Senate File 55.
Yeah, I remember that.
Which was really sad. Those guys had trained all their lives and then they couldn't.
Yeah, not good.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate you hearing the bill today. I think what is probably just the easiest, if I hand it over to Mr. Wolken from Stearns County to give us a little explanation of the need for the bill.
All right. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chuck Wolken, Stearns County Park Director. This corrective amendment is basically to change the name of the recipient of the bonding money from Central Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails to Stearns County. We thought the statutory language was sufficient to award the grant to Central Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails, and the Department of Finance didn't have that same opinion, and so we felt that the best way to clean this up is to come back to the legislature and correct the recipient name. The intention of the original bonding award was that Stearns County would acquire this property, and it would be administered through the Central Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails, and because that wasn't allowed, we thought, well, let's change it to award the grant directly to Stearns County, which would acquire the same property and accomplish the same mission.
All right, Mr. Wolken. And so then Stearns County will continue to own this property?
Correct. This is an addition of 23 acres to a 241-acre regional park near Clearwater.
Okay. And so you've cleared this with the finance department or the bond council that raised the objection in the first place, that this will do the job?
That this was the cleanest way to take care of it.
Okay. And members, this bill is a bonding bill, basically. It's an amendment to the bonding bill from last year, so it'd have to go, presumably it'll go through Senator Langseth's committee and would have to either probably be rolled into his bonding bill or whatever.
Well, and
get a 60% vote on the floor of the Senate.
Senator Chair,
Senator Fischbach, excuse me, just one at a time, please. Senator Kubley, can I let Senator Fischbach respond?
That's fine. Go ahead.
And Madam Chair, we'll check on that to make sure, but I spoke with Senator Langseth a while back, and he didn't necessarily indicate anything, and it did travel by itself and is waiting on the House floor in the House. So maybe we'll have to, you know, ask some more questions about that and understand a little better about how it can.
Senator Fischbach, it's not that it has to be part of the bonding bill, but I would think that might be where it would end up. But that's up to Senator Langseth's committee, I would think. But it would have to receive a 60% vote.
And be a House file.
And be a House file because it is a bonding bill. It's a mini, teeny, tiny bonding bill. That's all we were saying, so that it does have those special rules. So it could either go by itself or as part of the bonding bill. But I guess the full finance committee would get it after us, and then presumably Senator Langseth's committee would review this as well. Senator Kubley.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Fischbach. So who is the Central Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Coordination Board that the money is being taken from?
That particular board is a organization set up in state statute, Sherburne County, Benton County, and Stearns County. So we tried to coordinate with St. Cloud as kind of the hub area. All of our regional parks and trails activity amongst the three counties. And the statute's set up that the Regional Parks and Trails Coordination Board could administer state grants, which was what we were anticipating, and that's where we get the different interpretation.
So Madam Chair. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Wacken. So they're in agreement with your move here to fund this particular project?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
We do have a quorum present. Just wanted to note that for the record. Senator Fischbach, will there be any, has there been any problem, or Mr. Wolken, in terms of the delay of this? Is the land still available? Is there any danger that it won't be available?
Our purchase agreement has expired. We expected to close on this last November. The seller is sticking with us with the understanding that we thought we could maybe get a quick corrective amendment through the legislature. And so she's kind of waiting on that. She understands time is of the essence, and that's the reason that we, I guess, are kind of bringing it up as soon as possible in the session.
Are there any other questions from the committee? Would anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 55? Would anyone like to move the bill? Senator Hand raised his hand first.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Hand moves that Senate File 55 be recommended to pass and referred to the full Finance Committee. On that motion, any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
All right, now we have, we're going to start the review of the Department of Natural Resources budget and focus today on the parks and trails. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner.
Yeah, Madam Chair, my name is Mark Holston, Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. Members, I know you're going to be focusing today on parks and trails and Department of Natural Resources. I wanted to just come up early here for a few minutes and just give you some brief opening comments. I'm not going to be able to be here Tuesday as you start off that process, but as you deal with the monumental task of having to deal with this budget over the next couple of months, we'll be making ourselves available throughout that period of time to come before you and answer those questions as I best can. I know when you get into the general topics next week, I just can't be there for Tuesday, so I just thought I'd come up today and make some just brief opening comments so that you can get into the Parks and Trails division and talk about those items. For many of you who are familiar with the department and the works that we are doing, it's important to remember that the department has three very specific mission items. We look at our overall mission. Our job is to conserve and manage our state's natural resources and the protection of that. We're also responsible for providing those recreational opportunities, both on the public lands, through our parks, through our trails, through our forests, through our WMAs, through our lakes and rivers. And so recreation is a major component of outreach to the public. And the other is the commercial use of those natural resources in a sustainable way. That is a major component of our state's economy. When you take those three mission points and bring them together, the inherent conflict that comes into play is dramatic, both internally inside the agency as we try to make decisions and externally when we work with the outside public. Many times, as I've witnessed conflicts occurring with citizens, with organizations, or even here in the legislature, it's in large part because either one, the lack of clarity of what our mission actually is, or people coming at a specific component and not looking at the whole piece that we're fundamentally responsible for. So if they're looking purely for an economic development of those natural resources, how that comes in conflict, we're stuck with trying to manage those equal parts and try to provide balance throughout the state in those natural resource areas. We also try to use, through our policies and through some of our funding, the ability to try to leverage items, leverage one of these three points to bring some balance in. We talked about this with Forest for the Future, or the Forest Legacy component. It's the using the interests of the public to be able to access private land for recreational purposes of hunting, fishing, and trail use. The economics of forest industry, to be able to manage those forests, to harvest those trees, to feed that industry. We used those two components to leverage money to provide the protection of that large-scale forest easements by buying forest easements, by buying the development rights and buying the recreational rights to those lands, but yet keeping them in private ownership. Using that protection model and leveraging those other two interests, we were able to provide some balance on those acres that we have brought into the Forest Legacy or Forest for the Future program, and as we talk about those in the future. Members, we've got three particular items that we are focusing in on as an agency about our trends, the trends that are long-term going to be affecting our agency. First, it is when we talk about outdoor recreation, the change in participation. Our society is changing. The demographics is changing. They are growing older. They're becoming more diversified. And a social shift away from some of the outdoor recreational traditional things that we have enjoyed in Minnesota of hunting, fishing, trail use. We're finding ourselves with those changing demographics and changing participation rates. In order to try to keep that outdoor culture alive in Minnesota, a necessity to invest in people. Invest in their ideas and their concepts of how they want to recreate so we can keep that cultural connection and that outdoor ethic that we so enjoy here in Minnesota. You're going to talk about some of that when Parks and Trails come up and talk about the change in direction that we're making there. Another one is renewable energy. Renewable energy, as the discussions and debates talk about renewable energy and biofuels, those have major landscape-changing opportunities for Minnesota. It's additional row crops. It's grass. It's using the forest products from the forest in a different way than we currently are. These changes and the use of these natural resources are fundamentally going to change what Minnesota looks like and how we see it and how we interact with it. We need to be mindful of that and understand that and be at the table as a natural resources agency in this energy debate. It's a trend that we see and understand the magnitude of what it could do, both positive and negative for us, and need to be engaged. The other one is the landscaping changes, both from biofuels and energy, but also growth and development. As we bring in millions of people into the metro area and that expansion of into the wilder areas of our state, as communities change in size and as those communities change socially, we need to be prepared to address and deal with those communities and their immediate needs within their neighborhoods, within their communities, within their county, and also provide and work on a statewide basis to provide those recreational trends. The agency is divided up into now 7 divisions. We used to have 6 or 8 divisions. We have combined parks and trails into one. Director Nelson and Forrest Bowe will talk about those. Divisions about ecological resources and water. Two separate divisions that focus, water's focusing on groundwater. We're responsible not for the quality but the quantity, both of groundwater and surface water, and the management of that resource. Ecological resources provides a lot of the science-based activity in the area on the ground and in the water, where water and land interface, and some of the more of the science, our pathology lab and some of those science-based activities that help guide some of the discussions between the other divisions. We have our forestry division, which manages millions of acres of forestry land in northern Minnesota. Fish and wildlife you're familiar with, and the game and fish activity and habitat development and population. Our enforcement division, and where they're spread across the state of Minnesota, and the conservation officer's responsibility both to the Department of Natural Resources but also to the Pollution Control Agency, to Bowser, to local units of government, both in recreational enforcement, game and fish management, wetlands, feedlots. They're spread across more activities than just the DNR. Our Lands and Minerals Division, which focuses in on lands being the real estate and legal transactions around land and the minerals and the mineral development going on in the state, traditionally in the iron ore, now taconite, as we move into the precious metals arena of copper, nickel, platinum, palladium, gold, potentially diamonds.
Excuse me, Commissioner. Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, would you go back and explain again what is your responsibility for enforcement? I wasn't following you. Are you just responsible for a certain part of the enforcement, or are you responsible across the board?
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, our conservation officers are full-fledged law enforcement officers. They have all of the law enforcement capacity or capabilities as any other law enforcement officer has. They are, through their dedicated funding streams, mainly their primary focus is game and fish violations, recreational vehicle, DWI in those recreational vehicles, issues around trespass on private lands, conflict resolution on public land between people and on the waters. But then they also do wetland enforcement for Bowser. They do some of the pollution for the Pollution Control Agency and Department of Ag. So they're involved in many facets beyond the Department of Natural Resources on natural resource law enforcement.
Thank you.
Go ahead, please.
Members, as I was mentioning before, just finishing the interest on the mining arena and the volume of exploration that is going on in Minnesota and the interest in development of those precious metals, as you're familiar with, and the growth of that, we're deeply involved in affecting that. Overlying that, those management activities, you're familiar with some of the particularly school trust fund issues. We're managing those lands for the benefit of the school trust fund and how they overlay many of these items. We break ourselves up into four regions, the Northeast out of Grand Rapids, the Northwest out of Bemidji, the Central Corridor, which is the Mississippi watershed from St. Cloud down to the Iowa border out of St. Paul, and then the agricultural Southwest out of New Ulm. And those four regions with our regional directors. Members, the budget, as it's made up of predominantly game and fish, natural resources fund, general fund, we are approximately somewhere between a third and a quarter of our funding is now through the general fund. The rest comes from the user fees of license fees from hunting, fishing, the natural resources fund of park users, snowmobile, trail users, and those arenas in the natural resources fund. They make up the bulk. So of our 300 and some odd millions of dollars that we have available within an annual year, approximately $100 million is available for from the general fund. In that is contained the open appropriation for payment in lieu of taxes, treaty payments with the tribal bands, and fire protection. We separate in the arena and firing, you'll get into this in more detail, but we have a direct appropriation to go out and prepare for fire, be positioned for fire, but then we also have access to the open general fund to go in and actually fight the fires when they start and manage those through. And then the game and fish funds.
Senator Pariseau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, to the lands and minerals piece that you mentioned, how do you get a lot of complaints around the state? I know that in our area we've got a lot of people who are trying to do something with the aggregate that's untapped at this point. And, of course, you know how NIMBY turns out by the busload. Are there a lot of parts of the state who have good aggregate that are actually being withheld from mining at this time? Or is it just certain areas that are more populated?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Pariseau, as you're familiar in the southwestern metro, southern metro, there are vast resources of aggregate within the metro area. But as the communities have developed and expanded out, they're becoming less available.
They're built over.
Aggregate resources are—they're becoming a more of a precious commodity than they were in the past. Mm-hmm. And those conflicts, as communities develop, as we move out from the urban core and the metropolitan core and into more of the rural landscape, those conflicts are only going to increase.
And not only, of course, the water quality is one of the concerns because people nearby are concerned about their own source of water. But the fact is that they build over those resources. And I say, whatever you do, I don't care if you let them mine next week, next year, next century. Just don't build over it so that you can't have access because you got yourself a gold mine there. That's my advice if anybody ever asked me. But there are some pretty tough neighborhood quarrels going on in some of those places.
Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. You know, does the DNR have any stake in the precious metals operations that are being proposed in the Northeast?
Madam Chair, Senator Kubley, when you say stake, do we have
are any of those operations going on state lands, or is there any kind of a lease operation or arrangement with some of those companies?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Kubley, yes. There are no one is in operation right now. They are in the exploration mode. That is going on state land or on state-owned mineral rights. Many of the mineral rights in northern Minnesota were severed from the surface rights, so they may not be exploring on surface state rights, but they're exploring to the school trust fund mineral rights that exist out there. So there is large quantities of state assets that are being looked at for development purposes.
Thank you.
Go ahead, please.
Madam Chair, I know when you want to get into the details more deeply next week, I'll try to make myself available to answer the questions of this community as you look forward. I just wanted to come before you and give you a brief overview so you can get into parks and trails. And as the next couple months unfold and the difficult decisions you have to make, we'll be here to answer those questions for you.
Commissioner, have you looked into the federal stimulus package, the bill that's been approved, and whether I know there's some wastewater treatment, and I don't know if there's anything there that has any connection to the DNR. Do you have any idea?
Yeah, Madam Chair, yes. There are some items that we're looking at specifically. We have folks looking at that package and how that unfolds as it moves through that process further, how we can come before you and explain how the approaches we would be looking to take. Some of it may be in the habitat side or habitat redevelopment. We're thinking from capital on the ground work that we can accomplish that will either meet some redevelopment opportunities of capital nature, trails or bridges, but also looking at facilities that we can use to upgrade our facilities either from an energy efficiency side or opportunities to do some consolidation and save our operational dollars and deal with our ongoing operational expenses using those dollars to leverage. So we're putting it through those filters, but also through what other opportunities are being provided.
Well, Commissioner, I'm asking all the agencies that come in front of us if they can come back to us with a specific list of items funded in the federal bill, which we should have a copy of it should be available probably by tomorrow, I think. I think the president's planning to sign it on Saturday. That's what I've heard. I don't know if they've written it yet. I presume they're going to try to vote today.
We got something,
Senator Rummel,
on our email
today. We already
today.
Have a draft? Okay. So it will be available very shortly, if not already. So we'd like just to get a report on what opportunities there are for Minnesota and what specific plans you have for tapping into some of those funds.
Madam Chair, we'll definitely provide those for you. We, like I said, our folks are looking at those opportunities and putting those together and also trying to identify what types of policies or procedures we may want to bring in front of you to expedite, such as design build opportunities.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. All right, let's bring up Mr. Nelson and whoever else is coming up. Mr. Meyer. Okay, not Mr. Meyer. He's just pressing a couple buttons. Yeah.
Chair members, Cortland Nelson, yeah. Director of Parks and Trails, our new division, and with me is Forrest Bowe, who's the Deputy Director and was the Director of Trails and Waterways under our former organization. I'd like to take a minute to just amplify the point that Commissioner Holston made about this new opportunity that is presented to us for this new organization. We have an opportunity, we believe, to do some great things. There are many good reasons that this decision was made. We certainly think the bottom line of that is we can provide better service, better resource protection, and have some cost containment measures that are going to be very helpful to us in the future. We are anxious to seize this opportunity and to really take advantage of this outdoor recreation challenge that's been issued by the commissioner. We'll mention that in several different ways during the presentation, but I wanted to start off and let you know that we feel this is a very fortuitous time for us in many ways. We're very excited about the future that isn't ignoring some of the financial challenges that we're going to have, but it's a very robust time for us, and we're pleased as an organization at this opportunity. We're going to quickly go through our recreation system for those of you who are not quite as familiar with some of our work, review some critical trends in greater detail, specifically focusing on that outdoor recreation connection. That's the one that really comes to bear with our vision. We have responsibilities with energy conservation, and we also have a lot of work with regards to the health and quality of our lands and our waters, but our primary driving force for our activities is the outdoor recreation component. We'll finish going over our priority measures and the 2010-11 change items. Many of you have seen this graphic before, but it's usually been in two slides. This is a blending of the former state parks responsibilities as it relates to the outdoor recreation system and the trails and waterways. The benefits of this great system are observed statewide. We have many fine opportunities to provide great outdoor recreation throughout our system. We have the benefits of great state support over many, many decades and have improved a system that we are very, very proud of. Our state parks bullet on the top one lays out the numbers in terms of our scale and scope of the responsibilities. We've got a map coming up that lays that out a little bit more clearly. We also have our state trail system, which is been in place for many years, encompassing the almost 1,300 miles of trails that have been developed for multi-use activities. We share state forest outdoor recreation responsibilities. Our 5 million acres of state forests have an outdoor recreation component to that, and whether it's the campgrounds or the trails activities on those, we have a lot of responsibilities there. And then, of course, our system of water trails, we'll get into greater detail on these great opportunities that we have to expose Minnesotans to our water-based recreation system. We serve in the state parks unit approximately 8 million visitors a year. It's an interesting to note that in real people, this is around 1.5 million Minnesotans who visit a state park each year. To give you a sense of comparison, there's about 1.3 million fishing licenses that are sold, and somewhere sniffing in the neighborhood of 2 million people who go to a Twins game. We have very solid numbers when it comes to our recreational activities on the state park side. On the water recreation users, I want to draw your attention to the outdoor recreation users. On the second bullet there, this is an interesting number in that it shows that for the first time, our recent statistics show that ATV registrations have now surpassed snowmobile registrations. You have monitored that trend, those of you who've been on this committee or others, for some years, and this recent registration period was the first time that our ATV registrations surpassed the snowmobile registration.
Also, Nelson, I'm sorry, I just have to interrupt you. It looks like that says that each of us, per capita, we each own 866,000 boats. I don't think I'm reading that correctly. So tell me, what's the number per capita of boats that Minnesotans own?
We have the highest per capita in the nation, mm-hmm. and those are 866,000 registered.
Total. And so what do we have, almost 5 million people?
Yes.
So one in five people have a boat,
sure,
or something like that. Okay.
Or I would suspect there are people who own two or more.
But probably not too many own 866,000. Yeah.
Just one person.
This is a graphic about our state park system, and would want to have you recognize the three biomes that exist in Minnesota, the prairie, the Big River ecology in Savannah area, and then the North Woods. And we have a strong program that I'm going to get into in a little bit more detail that I know you're very interested in terms of how we manage those responsibilities. Our primary purpose here is to preserve, restore, and reconstruct the finest examples of natural, cultural, and scenic resources. That's actually embedded in our legislation as an organization. The state trail system graphic shows the current state park system, state trail system, and those that have been created and authorized through legislative activity. We have 26 state trails that have been authorized, totaling 2,500 miles. Of that, we have 21 trails that have been at some level developed, totaling 1,266 miles. And of that, we have almost 600 miles that have paved surfaces. So again, there's 26 trails that have been authorized, 21 that are in some form of development and use, and of that, about half of those miles have been paved for the variety of users. We also have use of public water-based recreational facilities, and this is boating, recreational boating and fishing opportunities. We also have 30 designated river and canoe routes totaling 4,300 miles, so a very extensive land and water trail system. I want to talk a little bit about the door that was opened by the commissioner, that being the variety of trends that we're trying to deal with. This one is particularly important and would want you to understand the implications of it. We may have spoken to you about this before, but we felt that it was worth mentioning again. The graphic represented here shows that the 20 to 34 age group has a lower level of participation than the 35 to 44 age group. And this has been validated both by primary research as well as secondary research. The striking component of this is never in the decades of compiling this information has that youngest age group had less outdoor recreation activity than the next one, the 35 to 44. And that is somewhat at the core of DNR's interest and our interest at reaching out to new users, making the connection through our various programs with those folks who haven't participated, haven't been exposed, or are choosing not to be active in outdoor recreation activities. And this is a quite a dramatic change from what has historically been in place. The downward trend with age is very normal. But again, that first pillar, that first graphic measurement is the one that stands out to us and where a lot of our work, a lot of our efforts are going to be focused in the next few years to try and connect and attract that age cohort to Minnesota DNR activities.
Excuse me, Senator Pariseau.
Madam Chair, Mr. Nelson, do you think that might be because that the 35 to 44 are probably taking young people out? And so they have more incentive now to get out of that in that age group because they're introducing new people to the things they enjoy. To me that might be a trend in some of their activities reflecting the people they take with them.
Madam Chair, Senator, the primary drivers from our research that I'll get into here in a few minutes would say that the number one issue is time, that group does not have the time. Number two, it is they have competing activities that draw their energy away, whether it's youth sports or family or dual incomes or whatever. The third would be access to information, that they don't rely on friends and paper materials to gather their information as much as they do the web and other sources of gathering data and information for trip planning and day use. Those would be the top three. Farther down the list, interestingly enough, is a cost. We suspect that last year, certainly a factor somewhere in that would have been the cost of gasoline for some people who were traveling.
Exactly. Thank you.
Okay. Our overarching department strategies, has been mentioned, increase in outdoor recreation participation through our marketing and our outreach activities, and also that Parks and Trails will serve as a gateway to the out-of-doors for the purposes that I mentioned in the previous couple of slides.
So, Mr. Nelson, what are you doing to be more, you know, internet-friendly, and so that all those young people who are on the internet all the time are finding out parks about parks?
Madam Chair, we have a number of successes that we worked through this last year, particularly with our web-based information, making technology available in the parks where we have GPS units that can be checked out, can be rented, the geocaching series of activities that I think most of you heard about last year. We had 20,000 kids who participated in parks in geocaching hunts around the park system, and that's that intersection between being outdoors and having some technology available. We have our first Wi-Fi set up at Itasca State Park. We have our first touch screens are now online at a handful of our parks, and we want to put more of those in for individuals who can come. They can address their information needs through a keyboard, and they get a printout or they get information that they want. So many, many efforts that we are moving ahead on. None more important, Madam Chair, than an improved website. All sources of data, all research, both primary and secondary, say the better website we have for all age groups, the better website we have, the more people are going to end up in having some kind of an outdoor experience that hopefully will be state parks or trails related, but would at least they'll be getting outdoors.
And are you measuring how much use your website is getting?
Yes, we are.
Is it going up or down? Or?
Madam Chair, it is going up continually. And in order to get ahead of that issue, we will be having our first webmaster that will be strictly for state parks. This is the person who manages the content for Parks and Trails information. It isn't about the mainframe and the hardware and the packages. This is getting stuff out the front end for people who want information. And that will help greatly. I think there is a companion project in the department for the overall DNR website, and we are working on a partnership that I was hoped to announce today, but I can't, with Explore Minnesota, that will also link those two websites in a much more cohesive and clear manner.
Do you have, you know, a marketing or advertising budget? Do you spend any time and money on that?
Madam Chair, we have a full-time marketing person in state parks that we hired 2 years ago. We have a marketing plan that has annual targets that addresses the issues that you have brought up. And we have our first $50,000 that we have committed to our marketing efforts in real dollars to carry these out. We also have a new public affairs person in state parks that will be augmenting these outreach efforts. So we're feeling naively optimistic, maybe, about how our activities are going to be reaching out for these new users. All of this is underneath the progress that has been made by Colleen Coyne, who's our communications director for DNR, who is doing many of those same things and others in terms of contacting providing good information for people.
But without those new staff positions and rolling that out, can we expect this year to see increased visibility for the parks? You know,
Madam Chair, we have a target of 400,000 new users to state parks and trails that will be the manifestation of these activities that I'm going to be going through here in my bullets.
All right.
This pie chart, Madam Chair and members, represents the biennial budget. The general fund component, of course, will be heavily scrutinized, and we are aware that we have a large responsibility, particularly in the state parks unit. We receive a high degree of those general fund dollars, and we are very aware of the situation that we're in. The Natural Resources Fund is the composite of all the special fees and charges and dollars that come to DNR. These relate principally to our trails and waterways activities. And so in the presentation, that follows will be getting into, should you desire to, the Off-Highway Vehicle Fund, the Snowmobile Fund, and the various funds that we have that develop these dollars. The water access account is an arrangement with from the Game and Fish Fund, money that goes to our water access programs for the creation of those water access sites. The federal funds that you see at the top are largely trail-related matching grants. So that gives you a general picture of where those dollars go. Our strategic objectives that we have covered in six areas and 12 slides, you can see represented here. We will do them in order of priority for the outcomes and the measurements. Many of our primary responsibilities are really involved in those bullets and consume most of our energy and activities in terms of protecting resources, providing good services to our visitors, and taking care of our grant and community responsibilities. The first objective, outdoor recreation, this encompasses the large amount of day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month activities that we have in managing our parks and our trails, and to a lesser degree, our water access sites. We have 900,000 overnight visitors who stay at state parks. That program involves lots of moving parts and how they come together in terms of maintenance, public service, public safety, health and safety issues. We have tried to augment by way of our efforts over the last couple of years to improve in this particular area. In many ways, we have a much smoother reservation system that services those overnight guests. We have a new financial management program that is actually related to the way that our reservation system gets managed and the software components of that. We replaced, these are some highlights from the last couple of years, but I wanted to take a moment to mention them to you. You can see the electric vehicle there in the photo. We replaced 15 gas-driven pickups with 15 electric pickups, and we have those distributed around the state, and we would expect that we would expand on those. Later in the presentation, you will see our first fully off-the-grid building. We remodeled the Camden State Park contact station, and so we have a turbine and a geothermal heating system for heating and cooling, and we have six or seven other building projects that we are on the list that we're going to be getting to for that conservation, important conservation component. We had 156,000 hours of volunteer time. If you figure 2,000 hours per full-time equivalent, that's 70-some full-time people in terms of the equivalent work that gets done by those 156 hours of volunteer time. We completed our division marketing plan, which I showed you, and we also have had a good, healthy increase in our day use visitation. One of the interesting things that happened last summer in all the gas stuff was that we had about a 16% increase in our day use visitation. So we're very interested in continuing that trend line, as you might suspect. I did want to mention our measurement of our success in very real terms. Every few years, we do a deep piece of research. It has always been with University of Minnesota, and we completed that late last fall. This was a three-part piece of research involving first focus groups that a firm was hired to conduct focus group interviews. What are your opportunities to visit state parks and trails? What are the barriers? What are your fears? This was really trying to help stage an accurate social science survey piece that would be conducted then that next summer, which it was. We collected 1,500 mailed-in surveys that were completed at about a 70% completion rate, which for any social science survey is a good, healthy rate. And I've got lots of information about preferences and barriers and desires and facilities and fees and demographic information. It's a rich arena of material for us, and we're beginning to feel good about using it and applying it. We also followed that up then with a resident survey, and we had 774 completed resident surveys that asked some of those same questions, but more of that, Madam Chair, was focused on the barriers of attending or visiting a state park or a DNR facility. What keeps you from coming? Where do we get lost in all of the things that are going on in life? Because I thought we have always, as an industry, asked maybe too many questions of people who are already there and not enough questions of people who haven't been coming. And so we tried to push back at that a little bit, and we were successful at that. And I believe that for our marketing, for our facility development, for our outreach, for our health and safety, that we will be developing with you a much more targeted and focused set of solutions, somewhat based on this good empirical research. Parenthetically, I would also add that this spring, University of Minnesota will complete their multi-layered, multi-level trails research, and there will be that same kind of information that when we meet again a year from now, if not before, we will be able to lay out to you and to communities who are involved in a myriad of trail activities. A very, very robust piece of research that we're anxious to see. I don't think I made the point on this graph. What this basically says is that over 90% of our visitors who were handed a questionnaire as they left the park and then mailed it back in expressed a level of satisfaction at their state park visit. And this is a measurement that has gone up. This is the highest ranking ever that we've ever had in Minnesota state parks. Lots of questions in the Met Council presentation earlier on this natural and cultural resource component. So, Madam Chair, when you would like to dive into some details, Ed Quinn is with us today, who manages that program. The highlights of this are basically as follows. We have an opportunity with this new organization to expand the success of this program to our trails principally, and a lesser degree to our waterway environments, our shoreline environments. We have conducted biennially 9,950 acres of prescribed burn management, which is a tool to manage a number of the problems that we have. We have a seed program, a seed harvesting program that allows us to save spending $500,000 on native seeds that we are able to do ourselves and to then use those seeds in our state parks as we try and get our prairies back to a healthy state.
Who do you use to harvest all those half of those seeds that would cost $500,000 to buy?
Pardon me?
You said you hand harvest those seeds and save $500,000?
Madam Chair, some of them are hand harvested. Much of it is done with typical combine equipment that is modified for our use.
So there must be some labor cost to doing that, but it's still
true.
Saving you.
Madam Chair, the actual total cost was $120,000, and so at the gross level, the replacement value of the seeds was $630,000. The labor was $120,000, so the net was $500,000 that we did not have to spend on seed for our purpose. Maybe if I could give a couple of you a backdrop for either questions now or when we meet later, Madam Chair, with regards to our lands. We have 226,000 acres in state parks that are under our ownership, 226,000 acres. Of that, 50% of those lands, whether it's prairie or forest or savanna, is in a relatively healthy state, and we apply maintenance measures like occasional fire or buckthorn removal or whatever the case may be. Fairly healthy lands, and we maintain those. Then we have 25% of our land that is being managed to enhance biodiversity. Now, it might be an intensive effort to restore prairie. We've got decadent forests, and it may be an effort to remove invasive species and to take down some of that decadent wood fiber and replant behind it with more appropriate. And then we have 16% of our lands, which is in a reconstructed mode. And those of you who are involved in the bonding scenario are aware that if the bonding dollars can be used to transform land. So if we have a farm field and that then is going to be put into native prairie, that's a transformative action, and we can apply bonding dollars to do that. And that's a series of years of many steps and many, many events. But 16% of our land is in that transformative mode, and we use bonding dollars primarily for that. 3% of our 226,000 acres has got something on it that we built, a road, a campground, a trail, a restroom. So 3% has been laid over with some type of facilities or impacted by some type of facilities. And then 6% is open water. So we're working on lands somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 to 40% of those 226,000 acres beyond just simple maintenance and in pursuit of our established goals for a desired future condition. We have mapped all of our lands, and we can tell you where we're at now and where we would like to be with regards to the dozens of different types of sub-bio descriptors, the plant mix, the cover type, the forest type. So we have targets, Madam Chair, and we are driving towards those targets. I can assure you that this is the third state park system that I've run. I'm well aware of what's going on in my profession around the country. No other state is doing what we're doing with regards to our state park lands and the natural resource management. Madam Chair.
So, okay. Well, I was going to ask, so you said you have targets and nobody else is doing this. Nobody else has tracked all this information, or nobody else has an aggressive plan to restore the lands to their natural state? Is that what your targets are intended to do?
Madam Chair, the latter.
Okay. And you said you have targets. It sounds like, okay, I got the 3% has buildings and pavement on it, and 6% is open water. And so 90% of it, maybe I missed some of the other percentages, but is basically in a natural land of some sort.
Madam Chair, let me introduce Ed Quinn. He can drill down from there.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee. Perhaps one example of the targets is, for example, prairie, which many of you are aware is a very rare ecosystem in the state. We used to have 18 million acres. Now we're down under 200,000 for the state. In state parks, we have determined that there are 16,700 acres of prairie that should still be restored on park lands. And so we have annual targets for acres that we're trying to restore to move toward that target, and we have similar ones for forested communities and things like that.
So your targets, what kind of a time scale do you have to finish restoring all these lands?
Sure. I'll use prairie again as an example. Currently, we are able to initiate reconstruction on 465 acres a year. And so at that rate, we anticipate that it will take us approximately 40 years to complete that work.
And that's just the prairies?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. And how much money would that be per year then, based on that 40-year goal? What's the limiting factor?
Sure,
money and
sure.
People?
Yeah.
Or both?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It is a couple different things. We estimate that it's about $738 per acre to reconstruct an acre of prairie. That's for sort of the first 2 years of the work, and then about $300 an acre for the next 3 years to get that into what we consider a place where that's a fully established piece of prairie that can then be maintained with fire on usually about an every four-year basis. I'm trying to do the number in my head. If you take 465 and multiply it by 738, that would be the typical amount that we would need for a year to be able to move forward at our current rate.
And you're selecting the land that you're talking about that's targeted is remnant prairie that has go ahead. Maybe you
sure,
can answer
sure,
that.
Madam Chair, the lands that we have identified for prairie reconstruction are those that were prairie historically and have now been plowed or transformed into some kind of old field, agricultural field, that we are now trying to transform that back to what it once was.
So they could be in all kinds of conditions.
Yes.
But
yep.
That might not have any prairie plants on them. Or they might be covered with trees.
That's correct, Madam Chair. We have most of them are some kind of old field, but there are some gravel pits, some other things like that. Typically, the sites that are in a native plant community that have sort of just transformed over time, prairies that don't get burned often enough will tend to move toward a savanna or a woodland community. If those are in good quality, we are not looking at trying to reconstruct those. So we did an actual unit-by-unit assessment to come up with that 16,700 acres.
And so you're trying to take a gravel pit and restore that into a prairie? That's one of your goals?
In some cases, there might be an old gravel pit that was on state parks land that, as you may be familiar, particularly out in some of the western parts of the state, prairie is very typical for a native plant community on top of a gravel ridge.
Okay. And the number we have is about $344,000 would be that math that you mentioned. And that's, how much was that for again? That was per?
That would be for 465 acres.
Which is the total?
Which is the total that we are reconstructing on an annual basis.
All right, Senator Hand, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to get a handle on this as well. And correct me, but we've got some 300,000, 200,000 acres of prairie right now. Is that what your statement was in the state? And there's an additional 17,000 acres that are in state parks that are under a rehabilitation process. Is that, do I have those numbers about right? Can you clarify that?
Senator, Madam Chair, there is 16,700 acres that we are attempting to reconstruct. There's about 12,000 acres of existing prairie and reconstructed prairie in state parks. So the total that we anticipate for prairie at the end is somewhere in the neighborhood of 29,000, 30,000 acres would be our desired future condition target. When we've gotten everything reconstructed, the state park system would contain approximately 30,000 acres of prairie.
I see. And Madam Chair, just I thought you originally mentioned that there was more prairie than that. Is there prairie that is outside the state park that would be more than the 30,000 acres? Is it 30,000 acres of prairie, the state part, and then there's some other part that isn't state? Or
Senator and Madam Chair, yes, there are the figures that I'm giving you are only for lands that are within the state park system.
What's the scale?
The scale overall is pre-settlement, there was approximately 18 million acres of prairie, and today I believe there's about 169,000 acres of prairie.
Okay.
What was that number? Sorry.
I believe. Yeah, I believe the number is approximately 169,000 acres of remnant prairie remaining today.
In Minnesota, it's about 1% or less.
Right. It's less than 1%.
Senator Dill.
Well, Madam Chair, if I heard this right, I think you said it was going to cost over $700 an acre for the first year or two to reestablish a prairie, and then $300 an acre for 3 years, something like that. I think I heard you say something to that effect. And I'm somebody who has restored some prairie on some CRP land, maybe about 100 acres or so at various times. And I'm kind of, I can't understand how you could spend that much money restoring prairie unless you're doing something else like bulldozing in gravel pits or removing trees or something, but just in plain tillable land, it's a little hard for me that you could spend that much money. So could you explain what you're doing that would run the bill up that high?
Sure, Senator and Madam Chair. And these are statewide means, so it's trying to cover everything. typically for our site preparation, when we're going into an oil field situation, we're going, sometimes we're having to remove woody vegetation first. After that, we are utilizing herbicide to treat the brome grass, the other invasives that are on that piece. We usually then need to burn that cover off. Typically, we apply at least two herbicide treatments to that piece of ground before we put the seed in. And then as we move after that, you usually need 1 to 2 mowings after you've got that seed in the ground so that you're not shading out those very young prairie plants. And then we are also in that early part, we're doing it follow-up invasives control to ensure that they aren't swamping the natives. And then our prairie reconstructions are also really diverse in terms of what we're putting in the ground. We typically will put in 7 to 8 species of grass and somewhere between 25 and 40 species of forbs in that.
Is that how you do it, Senator Dill, or do you do it?
Well, Ms. Madam Chair, the best way to do it would be to plant a Roundup Ready crop for 2 years in a row, Roundup Ready soybeans and Roundup Ready corn, get everything cleaned up, get all the quack grass out of there, all the thistles, and so you got a nice, clean, weed-free seed bed, and then go back in and plant your prairie grass. But it sounds like you're using the two applications of Roundup probably in the same year. You're not planting a crop in there, but you're applying it twice to make sure you've got the weeds, and then you're planting the prairie grass after that within the same planting year. Is that right? So you don't have a crop to, or are you using some Roundup Ready crops?
Senator, Madam Chair, no. We usually, most state park land doesn't have active agriculture on it, so oftentimes what we're dealing with is an old field situation, so we're having to go in and remove that with typically two applications of Roundup in that first year. And then depending on how everything goes, we are either then planting into that fall or the following spring.
Okay.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't want to be heretical here, but I want to understand that we've got, I think you said, about 16,700 acres of prairie land, and we're trying to restore another 12,000 acres. It's so a total of about 30,000.
Right. Senator, it's the river. We have 16,700 to restore.
To restore
12,000 existing.
Okay. And my question is, why? Is 12,000 not enough? Is it a question of geography that we want to have prairie in different places and we don't? Or it seems like a fairly costly, lengthy project, 40 years of work at significant cost every year to do this. And we're going to gain another, you know, double the size of the prairie we have in the state parks, which there's prairie outside of the parks, as you mentioned, too. And I'm just wondering, what is the rationale to do it beyond just the – I understand there's an intrinsic value in having it, but why that number? Why – I mean, why 12,000 or 16,000 more acres? Why not 5,000? Just what's the rationale?
Sure. Thank you, Senator, Madam Chair. As you're probably aware, Minnesota Statutes 86A05 sub D 2 C, it's when I have memorized. there are four very specific things laid out that state parks are directed to do. And they are directed to preserve and perpetuate natural features that were present in the area of the park. We are also supposed to preserve and perpetuate other scenic, scientific, historic, and natural features. We are supposed to reintroduce species that were once present in the area of the park that are now missing. And so we take that part of our mandate very seriously, and so we look at what are the what were the pre-settlement conditions at that park. And so that's part of the rationale for why we're doing this. We utilize the information that we have in the public land survey and other indications on the ground to tell us where that native prairie was. And the other benefit that comes to us beyond the native vegetation is that prairies in Minnesota contain more endangered and threatened species than any of the other biomes. And so by doing this, our hope is that by reestablishing larger pieces of contiguous habitat, that we will ensure the preservation of some of these rare species.
Thank you.
That was very helpful. It's a good question, Senator Hand. It's always good to ask kind of those basic questions. Why? Why does it matter? And that's a good answer. Appreciate it. So maybe this is more for the members of the committee. The reason that this issue, why we ask these questions about metro parks, too, is that in the Heritage Council, where the discussion is about how to allocate the dollars from the constitutional amendment that the voters passed, and, you know, we divided it into parks, clean water, and habitat protection, and the habitat protection piece is intended to protect, enhance, and restore our state's natural lands, and it specifically includes prairies as one of the named areas or biomes in, it says that in the Constitution. So does it make sense that some of that prairie restoration could be paid for by habitat dollars rather than having that just be the responsibility of the Parks and Trails budget? I'm curious if anyone has an opinion about that, because I heard a message from many of the members of the Citizen Council that they didn't believe anything in a park was worthy of habitat protection, that was a park's problem and not their problem. So I'm curious what the reaction of committee members is on that. Senator Rummel?
I think going beyond that, doesn't the new legislation require that we do not supplant? Mm-hmm. And so some of the things that the DNR has been doing on behalf of these restorative projects seems to me that's part of the traditional funding, and that neither the Heritage nor the Parks should be having to pick up what was once traditionally part of their work.
That's absolutely right, Senator Rummel. So we need to be really cautious about that and not trying to replace what you're already doing. But, Mr. Quinn, didn't you come to the Heritage Council, and were you there the other day? I thought so.
Senator Anderson, yeah, that's correct.
Among others who were presenting to that group some recommended additional work that could be done if there was additional funding. So it was presumably not intended to supplant what they're already doing and what they're already funding in their budgets, but to do work that they haven't been able to find the funding for. And so it's just something that we're going to have to discuss and grapple with as we move forward in our budget process, where those kinds of additional projects, if we want to do a bigger and better job at protecting and restoring prairies than what we've been able to do in our current budgets, where should that money come from? Senator Chaudhry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The constitutional provision provides additional guidance as well, in addition to Senator Rummel's remarks, which are very astute, that the habitat money needs to be presumptively used for activities that are open to the taking of game and fish. And so I guess my question to Mr. Quinn is, when you are presenting to the council for additional dollars from the Habitat Fund for parks, were those proposals or those areas where that money was going to be used, were they going to be open for the taking of game and fish under your proposal?
Before you answer that, I would just clarify that what it says is open to the taking of game or fish unless otherwise prohibited by law, which I understood that to mean there's public lands or private lands for that matter that aren't always open, and parks are one of them that isn't always open, but that doesn't mean they're excluded because it's already prohibited by law to hunt in not always, but in some cases in our state parks.
Well, Madam Chair, I didn't say requirement because I am aware of that notwithstanding language. I said presumption. the unless notwithstanding other provisions of law is an exception. That's why it says unless. So the presumption is that the money will be used for activities that are open to the taking of game and fish. And so my question to Mr. Quinn is, when you made those proposals to the council, is it your are those proposals going to be open to the taking of game and fish?
Senator, Madam Chair, it's my understanding, as you're aware, there were two sort of major categories. One was related to acquisition and one was related to restoration and management, and that the restoration and management portion did not include the taking of game portion. That said, in the parks where we have proposed to do the prairie reconstruction, they serve something in the neighborhood of 300,000 visitors a year who are able to utilize those parks for fishing. And those parks also, when we determine that there's a need for a special permit hunt to take place, it does. And the two parks in the proposal were Afton and Wild River. One of those parks in the past 10 years was open for special permit hunting 6 of the 10 years, and the other one was open 9 of the last 10.
Well, Madam Chair, given that response and your question, my opinion is that if the parks are requesting money from the Habitat Fund to supplement activities that they have not been able to do, and that those monies will be used in areas that are open to the taking of game and fish, and that is for the council to examine whether their specific project provides adequate access for taking of game and fish, then I would support it.
So, Senator Chaudhary, are you saying that even if it's there's some access for hunting or fishing and some limits to that, that it's not, shouldn't be eligible for Habitat funds?
Madam Chair, no, I didn't say that. I said it would. I would leave it to the council and the people on there to examine closely whether the access is adequate for the taking of game and fish.
What does adequate mean?
Like I said, that would be for the council. And I think there are a lot of people on the council who are experienced in access to hunting and fishing, and they can determine that.
I mean, and from we what will Mr. make the final decision.
Pardon?
And we will make that final decision. So we'll review their recommendations, obviously. Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It just, as I hear Senator Chaudhary, it seems to me that if we think in terms of hunting and fishing, perhaps then the question is different. We have 226,000 acres that are parkland. And to me, the issue then is, don't we need to protect habitat in this land? So if the answer is yes, the answer to your question about do we need to invest money from habitat into this land, the answer is yes, too. So perhaps the way we need to look at this is how do we protect the habitat in the land, period. Not the land that is used for hunting, not the land that is in the park, is habitat, period. And so I think that we need to be careful about that, because when we talk about dividing this pot of money and exclude 226,000 acres from the possibility that they could access some funding for protection of habitat because of whatever the reason may be, I think that's it. It's a problem for us because this is a lot of land. So I would say that we need to really talk more about that possibility of making these available to the entire territory that needs to be protected in terms of habitat.
Madam Chair.
Senator Chaudhary.
Senator Torres-Ray, You're correct that money needs to be available to the entire park system. That's why we created a separate fund for the parks. That money can be used for any, you know, park and trails activity. Doesn't have to be for open for hunting. There is that pot there that doesn't have that string attached. The question was on this other portion of the amendment dollars, the habitat portion, whether that can be used for habitat in parks. And that discussion was had on how that money should be used when we crafted the amendment and passed it by the legislature, and then the voters voted on it. And the language of the provision for that portion, not for all of the dedicated funding dollars, just for that one-third habitat portion, is that there is a presumption that habitat money will be, must be open for the taking of game and fish where that money is spent. And if there's a park where that is using the money, where it is supplementing existing funding, meaning it's not replacing what they've been doing in the past, and there is access, and as I said, I think the council recommending these dollars can delve into those details, then I would support that money being used. Now, if there is a desire for habitat restoration in parks, and it's just not appropriate for the taking of game and fish in that park, and there are many instances where it's not appropriate, then you have, fortunately, a whole other fund as well that you can look towards. So, I mean, I don't have a problem with a park getting the habitat third if it's open to the taking of game and fish. And then if it's not, then you also have this other pot as well that's completely available in addition to the existing funding. So that was that's really the beauty of what we passed. You're right. There are times where Senator Chaudhry,
I think you made the point very well. I appreciate it. I think there's two different points of view represented here, and I think they're both valid. And I would think that a number of legislators and voters agree with Senator Torres Ray's interpretation of the language. And a number of people agree with yours, Senator Chaudhry. So I think we're going to have a vigorous debate about this, but we're not going to resolve it today. So thank you both for, you know, putting those ideas on the table. We're not going to make that final decision today. But I think there's very different and valid interpretations of that language in the Constitution. So let's move on. Thank you, Mr. Quinn, for your presentation, and thanks for the information.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, members, Will Whitman's spur here a little faster pace now to catch up. Our strategic objective number three is conservation education. We have referred to this earlier in our discussions. This is the outreach component. This is the gateway opportunity that we have to move into new arenas and to coordinate better among DNR what we do. Last year, we conducted 4,500 conservation education programs in state parks, and that was a dramatic increase in the service that we were able to provide. This was a direct connection to some of the financial assistance that you gave us in hiring naturalists and creating some extended hours of operations for our visitor centers around the state. You can see represented here on the graphic are a couple of numerical achievements that we have. We have much higher goals for this next coming year. We are on track with reaching these, and want you to be aware that we are reaching out in many different areas. Your earlier question about what are we doing with technology. We have 25 podcasts online. We have video casts. I mentioned the touchscreen terminals that we would like to have at a much higher rate, and even the opportunity where an individual could download a trail map system from some access point, so we wouldn't have to produce those paper products, and they could go out. Tremendously attractive to all kinds of people maybe tilting a little bit primarily at youth, but not necessarily. There's all kinds of folks that are very, very excited about this
program.
Our next objective is a trails and waterways operation and rehabilitation. We have 1.1 million trail users on our state trails. That was a question you asked of me to return to today. 1.1 million individuals who use our state trails. This is collected through random surveys, some on-site interviews, and this is a summer-only vote. So it really just represents that busiest time of the year. We have 26 state trails, as I mentioned earlier. 21 of them are managed and open to the public at some level. Of that, half of those 101,266 miles have improved surfaces. So one of our major efforts with this operation and rehabilitation is to extend the number of miles of asphalt that we have on our trails. That is the biggest target that we have in terms of operation with regards to our trails. And additionally, we have the state forest trails that I referred to earlier, our public water access sites. We have 1,500 plus of those. Many of them do not have resting facilities. Many of them have old and not very serviceable ramps and service areas, parking lots. We want to add information kiosks, and we also want to restore some of that shoreland, that the restored area around the lakes and the water courses for the health of those water environments. We have scenic easements. We have 335 fishing structures around the state that we maintain. That of course, is a very, very popular program and one that we hope to keep at a very high level of service. Some of you may be aware of the Safe Harbors program, which is really focused on Lake Superior. There was a ribbon-cutting activity that some of you may have been at earlier this summer where we dedicated the McQuaid facility. The next one queued up is the Two Harbors Safe Harbor Project. And this always involved a multiplicity of funding sources, so it takes a while to pull all that together and to get approvals and environmental clearances, but a very, very important series of improvements that have had along the north. Mentioned trails and operations, our maintenance measures, and as you can see by this graph, the green representing the available funds, the red representing the miles that have been authorized and have some level of operation by the state. And so our efforts here are to bring those two together. We gave the same presentation a year ago, January, and went into some detail about the need to take the unserviced portions of those trails once the acquisition has occurred and to bring them up to our standard. The available operational maintenance fund only allow for a minimum level of trail maintenance, and so the extra things that we could do and should do with regard to restrooms, drinking water, and signage are also a part of this effort.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to clarify a little bit here, you mentioned we've got, I've forgotten, how many miles of state trails currently?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we have 1,266 miles that have been developed and are open to the public. Of those, about half, or a little short of 600 miles, have improved surfaces.
Thank you. And Madam Chair,
Senator Hand.
Is there a difference in cost to maintain an improved trail surface versus one that has not been improved? Is it a substantial? I'm just trying to get at the, if you make the commitment to pave the trail or improve the surface, does that have long-term maintenance implications that are different than if you choose not to pave that? And can you just give us a little more explanation about that choice and why it makes sense to pave them rather than not? And
Mr. Bowe, are you going to answer that?
I will. Thank you, Senator. For the record, Forrest Bowe, Deputy Director of the Parks and Trails Division, and Senator Hahn's question. Certainly the asphalt paved trails do require a higher degree of maintenance efforts. We have several state trails, and those would be the Taconite State Trail, which is basically a snowmobile trail. It's in a natural surface, and certainly that type of trail does not need the extensive maintenance that one of our asphalt trails has. The graphic really shows our asphalt bicycle paved trails. And so you can see we have about 600 miles that are currently developed. But more importantly, we have about 25 miles of state trail that has been authorized. Many of those miles, there is an expectation by those communities then to have a blacktop bicycle trail in those areas.
And Madam Chair, what does it cost to pave a mile of trail? Just what's the cost per mile to do the paving?
Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, we're running between $75,000 to $100,000 per mile to pave a trail, depending on the area of the state, depending on the fuel price at the time, depending on the topography.
Okay. Thank you.
Can you tell us how many miles of ATV trails also? Roughly.
Madam Chair, yes. Maybe I can go into that now. As the legislature directed back in 2003, we've just finished a massive study of all 58 state forests, gone through and reclassified each of those, and done a road and trail designation on all of our state forest mileage. First of all, that included a couple of years of inventorying everything that was out on the ground, and we inventoried nearly 12 or over 12,000 miles of routes on the ground. After going through this process of several years now, we've reclassified all those state forests, and actually at some point very soon we're going to file a report that identifies all of those. But in short, after that extensive effort, we've identified, I want to say, about 2,000 miles of off-highway vehicle trails in our state forests.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Senator Pariseau.
Mr. Vo, in tagging on to what Senator Hahn was asking about, the cost per mile, and I'm thinking about the amount that you mentioned. Is that typically only a department expenditure, or are there local and matching local organizations that kick in for some of the paving part of it too, which is obviously pretty expensive?
Madam Chair, Senator Pariseau, in many cases we are able to match federal funds for the development of those projects. Not in all cases, certainly. But we are very aggressive in trying to match, get federal funding for the match of the construction. The maintenance of those trails is really a state obligation. Local trails, city bike trails, county bike trails, of course, then it's that other unit of government's obligation. But for the state trails, it is the state's obligation to do the maintenance.
I think of that simply because we have a lot of them linking each other and potential links coming up because, you know, some of the southern part of the state has a lot, like, for instance, the Hiawatha one's going to come in and the Cannon Valley, yada, yada, yada. And what's the name of the one in Bryce County? I forgot it already.
Would that be the Milltowns or Stagecoach?
Yeah, the Milltown Trail, I believe it's called.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned a minute ago that there's federal funds. So if this $100,000 a mile is the state portion, is that a match by federal funds then to do this trail maintenance and improvement, or does it depend on the – I'm just trying to get a handle on what the federal piece of this is, and I frankly, I'm a little bit lost at understanding why the federal government would have any interest in a trail that runs through, you know, western Minnesota, but maybe you can explain that.
Madam Chair, Senator, we are able to garner some federal funds through the Federal Recreational Trails Program, and it's a federal program They use a portion of the federal gas tax for alternate means of transportation. In other words, in many cases, bicycle trails. And so we take advantage of that as often as we can. But in many cases, you know, there's criteria for various projects, and it's not available at all times.
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead, please.
Madam Chair, I moved on to the next strategic objective, which is the issue I think that we've been moving around the edges of the planning, acquisition, and development of the trails, and represented in the graphic are where some of those dollars go. We have a number of annual achievements with regards to miles of trail developed, completion of projects. We mentioned State Forest. We had two equestrian trail projects that got completed this last year. I mentioned the McLean Harbor as part of the State Harbors program. We acquired 15 parcels to expand the public access for water-related activities, and also used the Game and Fish Fund to reimburse for some of the projects that were directly related to fishing and boating access. You asked, I believe, earlier in the week, Madam Chair, about the dollars that we have from bonding and where they would be encumbered at. And from 2005 to 2008, there was $42 million of bond appropriations for these activities. $13.2 million are currently completed or under contract, which leaves $24 million that we anticipate by the end of FY10 will be completed or under contract. The balance then would be about $5 million of the $42 million will not be encumbered or in play, if you will, from a financial point of view. And this is largely centered around the partnerships that we have developed in some areas, generally federal dollars, but not always. It just takes longer to get to the point of actually going to construction. That's a frame of reference that can be helpful. Many times they also deal with acquisition issues. Mm-hmm. If we have a situation where we can't acquire the land, then that trail project doesn't proceed until they can.
Yeah. Mr. Nelson, what about the Lake Vermilion State Park? I forget how much we authorized for that in the bonding bill.
Madam Chair,
20
you
or
authorized
something,
$20 million for the acquisition.
Are you counting that in your?
I'm not counting that.
Okay. Well, why don't you tell us? Might as well talk about that.
I'm sorry.
You might as well talk about that now.
Lake Vermilion, Madam Chair.
Sure.
There is no agreement to speak of with Lake Vermilion for the acquisition with U.S. Steel. Conversely, there is no activity by U.S. Steel to develop the property using their agreement that they have with St. Louis County. I'm not involved in the negotiations on that, and am not privy to where that particular acquisition is at.
So that money's sitting on the table, too.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
All right. Mr. Meyer, you want to add something to that?
Steel probably isn't getting the price they want.
Madam Chair, members, I can just to add on Director Cortland's comments. On the Vermilion negotiations, we are discussing with U.S. Steel. It is a slow process. The difference is in the cost, the numbers in the appraisals and the number that they want, and other concessions that they are looking at. So we're evaluating proposals. We've been meeting with them on and off all year long since last year at this time. It's our goal to have something done by the end of this first quarter of this fiscal year. So with any luck and a wing and a prayer, we should have that acquired, or we hope to have that acquired well before session's over, but session might not be over for a while, so maybe we'll have it done before spring is over. So,
what does the latest appraisal say,
Madam Chair? It's a difference of about $5 million where we're at right now.
You can't tell me what the appraisal says.
It's our appraisal is private data until that acquisition is done. Their appraisal still is about $20 million, Madam Chair.
Coincidentally, how much we appropriated. Okay.
Madam Chair, but the language is a little bit prohibitive, the language that was passed. So that's one of the issues we're working on, too.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, we're coming down the home stretch here. Forrest, could I ask you to address this outcome? We've got some passion around this issue.
Yes. Committee members, really this is an outcome that talks about our public water access program. We've got a very aggressive public water access program, and as you know, we have a lot of boats in Minnesota. We have a lot of water in Minnesota, and consequently, we have a good number of accesses. Each year, or each biennium, we try to purchase land on lakes and add another 10 to 15 public water accesses. In many cases, these projects go very smoothly. And in other cases, they take some time, then they're fairly complicated. As you know, land prices have skyrocketed on lakes over the years. And so we've, again, using federal dollars at every chance we get to capture the maximum amount of public accesses that we can do. And basically what we're showing is that for our target of FY08 and 09, we're meeting our target. We will have provided an additional 15 new public water accesses, and we've also redeveloped about 20 of those accesses in the last fiscal year. And then we would want to continue on that same pace of acquisition as well.
Okay, Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize if this is a really stupid question. When I think about our lakes and the issues of keeping them clean, and do we have any sense of when a lake has do we do anything to limit the capacity of a lake to have more boats and especially motorboats on it? Is there anything?
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, yes, we do limit the capacity of certain lakes. Most of the time that is done through local ordinances, and so we are able to limit the hours of operation on a particular lake through a local ordinance, but really needs to come up from the local level. So it's hours of operation, could be the size of horsepower, motors on particular lakes. There's a lot of things that we can do, but again, it's really driven at that local level and then approved at the state level.
Thank you. Senator Rummel, that's not a stupid question. Really.
Well,
there's no stupid questions, really. Just please always
I'm just thinking of our hometown lake, and every summer we have more and more and more boats, and a lot of the people have sailing and regattas, and then there's these motorboats and these little individual
jet skis,
and there's traffic congestion, so I don't know, but that's a local issue.
Well, it doesn't have to be a local issue, but I mean, unless somebody at the state wants to take it on, which, you know, you may not want to do, but it's not required to just be, I guess it's only local, there's no state restrictions, in other words. By law.
Chair, I think that a lot of times this is actually locally driven. So people who are on the lake want to have certain kind of peace, and so they kind of band together and find their own limits, I think.
Yeah, that makes sense. Absolutely. Yeah.
In cooperation with the department and every other option.
Another thing, Senator Rummel, that as a person who owns a boat and spend a lot of hours in it, I think the issue is not just the quantity, but also, the state of the boats that are in the water today. So many people have boats that they don't maintain. And you can see that when they get in the water, they spill oil and gas. Like, it's just amazing. So the regulations for the boat itself is something that I think we need to look into. There's a lot of pollution from small, very old boats that are in the river and the lakes. And I don't know about those kind of regulations for those boats.
That's a good question. I don't know either. Do we have any? Do we have any regulations on that? I mean, you don't have to do boat inspections, you know, in terms of the pollution control equipment. Is there any? I don't know. I'm not aware of any restrictions on that. All right. Why don't we move on, please?
Madam Chair, our Next and final objective is community assistance, kind of the very thing we've been talking about, and this really is made up of the 360 grants that have gone through the Natural Resource Fund out to communities. They are matched at various levels. They achieve any number of objectives in terms of trail, water, access sites, or other forms of training aid. We have a long history of expertise in this area. We have specialists who deal with the interested parties, and we attend their functions. We keep very close contact with them. This is one of our three legs in our financial stool, if you will. These are people who pay money in one form or another to get a service. And they want to know that their dollars are being spent well, whether they're snowmobilers or motors or whomever. And so we work very hard to make sure that that is handled and managed and appropriately, that those dollars are put to use. And this is a similar graphic to a couple that we've looked at, only the difference here, these are the application, this is the ratio of applications to the dollars available. Now, a good, healthy grant program should be oversubscribed 2 or 3 to 1 if you've got a good setup. And as you can see by the graphic here, we have many more requests than we have dollars available. And this is something that through our variety of dollars that, as we move ahead, that we want to try and address. It's a very strong, popular set of activities for DNR and for trails and parks and our waterways activities, and we hope that we can improve this graphic. Since 2001, 92 communities have benefited from 167 miles of trail connections and regional trails that have been developed. That question came up earlier in terms of what are communities doing with trails. But some of this money goes then to those community trails, and there are some cases organizations, if not government entities, that manage to take over responsibility. So that's another set of activities that comes out of ours. These are not state trails, but these are locally or regionally driven state trail activities.
Mr. Nelson, that reminds me, I have to ask a question. I've had constituents contact me, people with disabilities, who have said they've had trouble accessing state park facilities. What's the state of accessibility at the state parks?
Madam Chair, it needs to be improved. And when we get to the part of our discussion today about where we would like to go with some of our dedicated funding, it very directly relates to those accessibility issues. We are behind where we should be with regards to trails. We are behind in some cases with regards to access to restroom and health facilities. We're fairly good where we are in our campgrounds, but there's more that can be done, and we recognize that that is an area of improvement.
Okay.
Finishing up then, Madam Chair and members, these are the list of the change items that we have for you. The first, which you have talked about in your discussion with the Met Council, this is the legacy funding. The governor's recommendation is $6.54 million the first year of the biennium, and then 13.64 for the second year, and this is specifically for state parks and state trails activities. We are recommending that 35% of these dollars go to trail rehab and renewal, 35% go to parks rehab and renewal. Our gateway or outreach activities would be at 15%, so this is what would augment those efforts to connect and reconnect with new users and those who are not currently involved in our outdoor recreation services. To your earlier question, Madam Chair, we would be recommending 5% for resource management improvements, 5% for accessibility enhancements, and 5% for energy conservation. As we move to the second year, then those percentages shift a little bit, but they remain pretty consistent, and that's our effort at trying to address some of our issues from a supplement point of view and to solve and create new opportunities for ourselves. I would assume at another time we'll get into more detail about this constitutional amendment dollars, and we'll be able to get into that when the time comes. I might mention that what you see on the picture here, this is what I referred to earlier. This is the Camden State Park contact station. It was built in the 70s. It's the remodeling is coming to a completion. We're using geothermal heat to heat and cool the building, and you can see the wind turbine in the background of the top picture. That augments for 10 kilowatt, at a rate of 10 kilowatts, our electrical needs in the park, and when we're not consuming that, it goes back on the grid. So it's our first success at really plugging in at that level with two options for alternative energy. We have 8 or 10 in the planning stage at some various level. The next one that you'll likely hear about will be the Grand Portage Visitor Center, where we will be using geothermal as well as solar panels for to augment our energy costs. So we're moving ahead. We're trying to be very honest brokers of best practices and to share with the public how some of these things work. And we had lots of interest, particularly in the windmills. For those folks who grew up in this part of the state, windmills aren't as common as they used to be, and so it's a braking mechanism when people are driving by the highway. This is close to Highway 23, and they see this wind turbine, and it's at a smaller scale, as you might suspect, than the ones that you see at some other places. And so it's a nice conversation piece. But more than that, what you can't see in the panel is that we have a graph that reads the amount of energy that's being generated by the turbine that's either going back to the grid or is going into our energy needs for the building. And we will be expanding on that at a great level.
Expanding on that?
More energy building efforts, more alternative energy sources that will be plugged into our system, improving the efficiency of the buildings that we have online.
It might be nice to provide information at those sites about, you know, how much it costs to pay for this and how much ultimately taxpayers will be saving over whatever your payback period is. I think that would be valuable information for the public to appreciate, and how many pounds of carbon emissions are reduced, are offset. Those would be, you know, educational opportunities for the public that I think that would help support the establishment of these projects.
Madam Chair, I'm almost certain that is a part of it, but I will make sure and double check.
And I'm wondering, have you evaluated all of the building sites for solar across the state park system, or only selected ones?
Madam Chair, or only selected ones. It is a desire of management resources at all DNR buildings go through that kind of analysis, but I do not believe that we are there yet.
Well, you may be. I'm sure you're aware that the LCCMR had some discussion about money for solar at state parks, so that would be, it'd be good to have that information available.
Madam Chair, this is the local grants component of the legacy fund, the governor's recommendations. This would be $4.13 million the first year of the biennium, $8.62 million the second year. I believe on Tuesday you had some conversations with Met Council. This is still in development and in discussion among the partners. This will be managed out of DNR, and it is strictly dollars that would be available for annual grant application programs for parks and recreation and other kinds of activities that would come under that local grant statute, which I believe is in the fairly clear indication, 85, if I'm not mistaken. The 85.19. I think the point here is that there will need to be some discussions among interested parties about both the distribution processes. I was at a meeting yesterday of rural parks and recreation leaders who are trying to weigh in on this particular issue. The language holds that grants can be awarded to those facilities that are regional park significance, so there's some definitions that are also at play, and I would suspect this will be an item that will be debated in the near future. Okay. The next category is water, rec, and forest. Can I ask you to hit the high points of this?
Absolutely. Members, this is a governor's budget request for an additional $1.4 million out of the water recreation fund going to the Parks and Trails Division. And it's really about keeping pace with all of our existing accesses. As you heard earlier today, we have about 1,600 public water accesses located throughout the state. And those accesses have been developed and purchased and developed over the last 40 years. And some of those are in some kind of disrepair. Many of those need work at the boat ramps. Many of those need work on the shoreline. And so this initiative is really about sprucing up all of those accesses, making them so that we retain all of the storm water that's collected on that particular parking lot. We can restore shoreline for native species. If you are out in the lake country, you see some of our accesses and maybe have been degraded in the past by either wave action or how we've mowed or how even our neighbors attempt to mow their shoreline in the past. This is really about doing a lot of restoration in that shoreline area. Another part of this.
Mr. Bow, can I, just on that point, are you trying to change your shoreline management so that it's more native plants and not so much grass, you know, just turf mowed down to the edge, the way we're trying to encourage lakeshore property owners to change their management?
Madam Chair, that's exactly what we were doing. We heard a lot about that the last few years. We've been able to pick away at that a little bit, but this initiative will really accelerate that. And so the idea is not only to do that at our access sites, but also educate with interpretive signs, talk about the plant species, talk about the benefits, and have each of those access sites be that opportunity on the lake where people can go to take a look at how shoreline should possibly be managed. Of course, it's still up to the landowner to do that, but I think we can have a lot of influence in that area.
Senator Rummel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know this probably isn't the right time for an in-depth discussion, but this would be one of the areas that sounds a little bit like supplanting rather than supplementing. Wouldn't this traditionally be the work of the Parks and Trails system to do these things? And
Senator Rum, I'm not sure if this proposal is from the dedicated funds.
So you're not asking for, okay, that's fine. Thank you.
I'm glad you're watchdogging it.
Madam Chair, I would add one more thing. And this kind of gets into outreach to new participants and the whole idea of increased technology. This particular proposal also has a one-time expenditure of $100,000 each of the years of the biennium to provide downloadable GPS coordinates for every public access in the state. So whether you're in your car or whether you're in your boat, you can get to the public access. And in many cases, this is almost a safety concern, because if you are out in your boat and it's dark or the fog comes in, having that information in a GPS would get you back to the site.
I could have used that in the boundary waters once or twice. So I don't think you're going to put these in the boundary waters, but yeah.
And finally, another natural resource fund component, which is Outdoors Minnesota. And this is the effort that we talked about earlier to connect with specifically the Hispanic community and to build skill sets among new park visitors. This goes back to research and just what we all know about some of our populations that are not as comfortable in outdoor environments, and creating awareness, creating conversation, and having outreach activities around those. We've got some high targets that we want to aim for. And I would also want to add, Madam Chair, that there are many programs that are going on right now that are based in this kind of an outreach effort. We want to be better coordinated. We often have people in different divisions that are doing somewhat the same thing, and so this is an effort through a coordinated function to bring that all together, also to have more activities at our DNR facilities, particularly state parks, where if there's an education component or a training session or community involvement, we can do that at one of our facilities. We've got a school connection that's part of this. We want to do a better job of connecting with those schools. And have great hope for this, and this is the funding recommendation for this initial outreach component targeting the skill building programs and the Hispanic community.
What, which funds?
This is from Natural Resource Fund. It's an adjustment within.
Which part of the fund?
I can answer that, Madam Chair. Of this $470,000, $280,000 coming from the Water Rec account, $55,000 coming from the snowmobile account, $75,000 coming from the non-game account, and $60,000 from the parks account.
And finally, then, this is the roll-up of the governor's recommendation with regards to those various funds. At the macro level, $192.7 million for the biennium.
All right. Well, I think unless there's any questions right now, this is a good point to end today, and. We'll have to go through the budget pages and see if there's further questions or if we need further detail. Mr. Meyer?
Madam Chair, just in closing, I want to say thank you for the opportunity to start this discussion with the Division of Parks, but this is a relatively easy division to have a conversation with you with about the 2010-11 budget. There were no general fund reductions for this division just because of the funding sources that are there. And as we developed the budget, as Commissioner Holston was saying, we did look at the diversification of funding for each division and where those funds come from. Division of Parks and Trails is heavily general fund funded, so we felt because of the important activities that they are doing and the pressures they're facing, to take a lot of money out of the Division of Parks and Trails wasn't appropriate. Where we look at other divisions such as Lands and Minerals, we are talking about $1.9 million withdrawal of general fund from that division, over $2 million from Parks and from Fish and Wildlife. The Division of Forestry has some severe financial issues we need to discuss at length. A $5 million in 10 and $6 million in 11 from the Forest Management Investment Account that presents some significant impacts. So we do have a lot of work to discuss within the coming weeks and in next week in particular. The goal is to finish those discussions by the end of next Thursday, starting with Lands and Minerals, Waters, and Fish and Wildlife on Tuesday, and then going back to Forestry, Ecological Resources, Enforcement, and Operations Support on Thursday. So we do need to continue these discussions in an open and honest fashion to provide you as much information about the detail of those reductions as we have presented information about additions or new challenges or new opportunities here. So we do welcome that opportunity. And if at all possible, I'm going to try to meet up with members before that or during next week to help you answer specific questions that you may have about the DNR's budget.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate that. All right, with that, the meeting's adjourned.